The final edition Radio Hour is a work of satire intended for audiences who own books, gentrify neighborhoods, and say they like kale. Please consume responsibly, the satire, that is.
Hi, I'm Jeff Chrysler.
And I'm Tony Sotirios Hendra.
And this is the final edition Radio Hour.
We have a historic show for you this week that has a lot of history.
No, that's not what historic means. You mean historical.
Historical, hysterical, what's the difference?
There's a lot of... forget it. First, let's tell them the stories we decided not to touch with a 10-foot pole.
We let the Donald Sterling fracas alone, because this was the first time in living memory, and dead memory, that a plantation owner was actually fired.
We also certainly did not touch the fact that the Benghazi investigation is flaring up again like Republican herpes.
And we haven't gloated over Rush Limbaugh's rapidly departing sponsors, because, hey, it's not fair to kick a suppurating sack of puke-inducing human sewage when he's down.
But we do have an exclusive, heartwarming interview with the world's first 9-month-old heartthrob, Prince George of Cambridge.
A mouth-watering taste of how good for you McDonald's makeover of Ronald McDonald will be.
And on the 40th anniversary of Congress moving to impeach Richard Nixon, a long-lost National Lampoon Radio Hour sketch starring Chevy Chase, back when he was funny, and the legendary John Belushi, both being quite satirical.
So fasten your seatbelts in that GM or Toyota vehicle, and away we go with
the final edition Radio Hour!
McDonald's has recently announced that they're giving Ronald McDonald an image makeover, featuring cargo pants and a red rugby shirt. Ronald McDonald himself has also taken on a new persona in an effort to re-image the fast food company. The new Ronald recently held a press conference.
Ronald!
No, Ronald!
I have a question. Ronald. We're here.
Ronald!
Please.
All right. Calm the hell down. Yeah, you, go ahead.
Mr. McDonald, what prompted this entire re-imaging?
Good friggin' question. You know, with McDonald's having the rep of making crap food for the kids, the thought process was we gotta look like a different company that doesn't give crap food to the kids.
But don't you still give crap food to the kids?
What the hell are you talking about? Our Happy Meal has a couple apple slices in it. That's good. A couple apple slices.
But isn't the rest of the Happy Meal filled with unhealthy food?
What? It's got milk or juice. I'm wearing cargo pants. We're different.
But aren't you still serving the same food, but with different packaging?
You think I would wear a rugby shirt if the food wasn't different?
I don't know.
We got all kinds of crap that's good for you, like chicken and special sauce. No one knows what's in it. How do you know it's bad for you? And Happy Meals come with a toy. That promotes running around and crap.
You didn't answer the question.
Look, I'm sick of you turds telling us we're unhealthy. I'm a new guy. I look different, and we got a different menu that is the same, but in a new McDonald's package, so it's better for you. Besides, how bad is a burger anyway?
Pretty bad.
According to who? Wendy? The friggin' Burger King? Like any of that is gonna make your heart beat better?
Wendy's has healthy options.
Oh, right. Like, that's why you go to a square hamburger place for the friggin' salad. McDonald's is just as healthy.
How?
I look different. I got a new way of being me, and I'm telling you we're a healthy option. Now, I gotta go. I gotta grab a smoke by the fryer later.
Coming up, Jared from Subway is going to share with the public the health benefits of processed meats.
With Obamacare now beginning to succeed, and some Democrats up for re-election who've been avoiding it now embracing it, and polls beginning to even out or even trend positive on what the nation thinks of it, Republican operatives and right-wing pundits have begun attacking a reality bias that distorts the claims they've been making about the cataclysmic disaster it presents economically, culturally, and medically for Americans for decades to come. Rush Limbaugh.
My friends, reality, with a capital R, is unfairly skewed against conservatives. Reality has a liberal bias. That's why Obamacare appears to be not just meeting its goals, but convincing Americans of its vast superiority over our previous healthcare system, when we know in our hearts that almost no one has signed up for it, and people are being condemned to slow and painful death by millions every single day.
Right-wing realist and humorist Ann Coulter.
Look, no one could be more certain than me that Congressman Paul Ryan speaks absolute truth in the Hegelian sense. But when he claims he'll protect Medicare by replacing it, his words seem to ring hollow in the liberally slanted atmosphere of the world as it actually exists. I mean, come on! If we're to win the midterms, we need a reality far more in accord with our delusional idea of it.
Conservative pundit Dick Morris enlarged on the theme during an appearance with Fox News' Sean Hannity.
It's bad enough we have to overcome the liberal media, the liberal pollsters, the liberal voters in this country. But to be also shot down by the independent nature and existence of everything knowable, whether by logical inference, empirical observation, or any other form of experiential perception, sometimes it makes you feel like a motherless child.
You said a mouthful, Dick. Are you as sick and tired as I am of always being behind the metaphysical eight ball?
Absolutely. And I mean that in the Hegelian sense.
When I say Obama is the worst president, not just since Jimmy Carter, but in our entire history, why should his actual record be allowed to disprove that? It's outrageous!
I'd go further. I can say with incontrovertible certainty that Obama's the worst president in the history of every republic that's ever existed, or of any other human organization that has had a president. Now, why is that not only impossible to confirm factually, but objectively ludicrous? Why, Sean, why? Why is that the case and not its opposite? It's so damned unfair.
I know. I feel your pain. America, it's time to go over reality's head. Flock to your places of worship this Sunday. Beseech God to shift the entire ontological locus of the universe. Beg Him to eradicate the liberal slant that's built into the very nature of existence. There's only 7 months left, my friends. It's time to get unreal.
God, whose existence is impossible to prove or disprove in the phenomenological world, had no comment.
Hi, this is Tad.
And this is Connie.
From The Morning Show. Thursday, we'll get a house call from Dr. Sandy. A nutritionist will be explaining why you are what you eat.
I guess that makes Tad 300 pounds of undigested pork.
Connie always looks great. And she did it without diet or exercise. Just two fingers stuck down her throat.
That's sweet, Tad. But with you around, I never have a problem throwing up.
And speaking of things that are sweet, the lovely Kelly Ripa drops by to tell us all about her upcoming charity ball.
Charity ball? Why, Tad, that sounds like your honeymoon.
Thursday on The Morning Show.
Prince George of Cambridge just completed his first triumphant royal tour of Australia and New Zealand. The 9-month-old blonde bombshell wowed the whole white world with his fashion sense and camera know-how. We have an interview with the teeny dreamboat. Live from his private chambers in London's Kensington Palace. Hello, little Prince George.
Who the f*** is this?
The final edition radio hour in New York City. We spoke to you last summer when you were just a few days old.
Oh, you lot. How they hanging?
Lovely, thanks. And you?
Sore as f***. Me mum has this special grip for the media. One hand round me front, the other up me crotch, gripping me knackers.
Ouch.
F***ing right. That's me family jewels, that is.
Or in your case, the crown jewels.
I'll piss off, you f***ing commoner.
Wow. You already know about the British class system?
We need more class warfare in this country. Glasses need to be wiped out.
Well, wiping out the class system is pretty advanced for a 9-month-old. You're a bright little chap.
Who's talking about wiping out the class system? I'm talking about wiping out commoners. I made up a poem about it. A little class war is a very good thing, provided you're king.
Ah, so you could be a future tyrant, like your great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, George III.
A tyrant? That f***ing pussy? Letting the colonies go. When I'm George VII, I'm getting them back.
So you're going to be a real ruler, not just a figurehead?
Yeah, like my mum says to my dad. A prince is just a prince, but a ruler's 12 inches.
Well, that's very cute. Let's get back to your tour down under.
That's when she says it to him, when she's down under. Down under dad.
You and your mom certainly wore a lot of lovely clothes down, in those countries.
Down under dad, down under dad, get it? Down under dad.
Everyone loved your cute little outfit with the shoulder straps.
I look like that little wanker Christopher Robin.
I know! Everyone loves Christopher Robin.
I'd rather be Pooh.
Winnie the Pooh?
No, a big fat steaming turd. Who do you think I mean?
Well, your mummy looked great in her outfits. I adored that yellow dress.
My dad said she looked like a banana.
I know, LOL. He is so funny.
No, he's not. Whatever she wears, he says she looks like a banana. Like she's in a bikini. Oh, you look like a banana. He's not all there, my dad.
Well, one last question. Did you enjoy your trip to the other side of the world?
Better than being stuck home with that loony old bat grandma. She calls me Susan, after her favourite dead corgi. When I stay in Buck Palace, I have to eat with the yappy little f***. Wow, I'm hungry! I'm hungry! Wow, Mum! Mummy! Ma!
That's so sweet. Do you have any final cute little words for us Americans?
I want to suck my mum's soft pink nipples really hard.
Well, that's natural.
While I take a long, warm, wet pee in my nappy. Food and sex all in one place. Ma! I'm hungry!
Good night, sweet prince.
F*** off.
Welcome back to Fox News. President Obama has spoken out harshly against tuberculosis. So we at Fox figure, if Obama is against it, there must be something to it. Tonight, we bring on tuberculosis to tell his side of the story. Tuberculosis, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Sean.
So why does the president seem to have this vendetta against you?
I don't know. I'm just a small businessman. Some people are in the car business or the restaurant business. I'm in the business of infecting the pulmonary alveoli with my microbacteria, resulting in coughing, blood tinged sputum, and even death. Why does that make me the bad guy?
Isn't it the small businessman always the bad guy with the Democrats? You know, tuberculosis, some are calling you a folk hero for standing up to this president.
I'm just a simple pathogen that killed 1.5 million people in 2010. Mostly in the developing countries. But my family of bacteria came to America before the Mayflower. Why is this canyon bossing me around?
So you're not a fan of Obama.
I sure don't need Obamacare. In fact, I know a heck of a lot better without it.
You're a model for every American, sir.
Thank you, John. And now, apropos of nothing, let me tell you what I know about the Jews. I often wonder whether they weren't better off in concentration camps. I mean, right now in Israel, they're fighting for their own place. But in Auschwitz, they had their own place. Nobody else wanted it. Just think about it. All I'm asking you to do is think about it.
Let's talk about your new book.
Matter of fact, Jewish prisoners got a lot of thinking done. That's why they called it concentration camps.
You mean that ironically, of course.
Ah! Maybe Jews even had time to think about why they killed our Lord.
Sir?
And at Auschwitz, they had all the copper wiring because it was invented by the two Jews fighting over a penny. That's an historical fact.
We are having technical difficulties. Please stand by.
We are back, ladies and gentlemen, and I apologize for that interruption. We have had tuberculosis removed from our studio. I did not realize that our guest was an extreme anti-Semite, and Fox News in no way condones those opinions. Coming up, scabies. Barack Obama is against it, so we're bringing it into our studio. We'll be right back.
The final edition welcomes you to Constitutionally Speaking. I'm Roberta Martin Patroon, and my guest is former Justice John Paul Stevens, author of Six Amendments, How and Why We Should Change the Constitution. Justice Stevens, some say the Constitution can't adapt to changing times because people simply cannot change.
Oh, that's not true. When the Constitution was written, black people were considered three-fifths of a person. Now there are members of the GOP as well as owners of basketball teams who consider black people to be four-fifths of a person.
In your book, you propose adding words to the Second Amendment so that guns are a protected right only if you are serving in a militia. Do you think you'll live to see this amendment?
I'm 94. I don't think I'll live to see the next Game of Thrones.
I meant, is your amendment too radical to be passed anytime soon?
Well, I toned down the language from what I really wanted.
What did you really want the Second Amendment to say?
An unregulated gun nut being necessary to the insecurity of a free state, the right of Georgians to scare the living shit out of people shall not be infringed.
Did you mean Georgians specifically? That seems a little unfair.
Of course it does. I meant everybody in the South.
With other proposed amendments, you want to see Congress limit campaign financing and end political gerrymandering. Are you too idealistic?
I agree. There are some things we just have to accept. For example, I don't see any way we can un-greenlight Star Wars Episode 7. But on the other hand, next year, for the first time in 10 years, the U.S. will have a late night without Craig Ferguson.
So you're saying anything is possible?
I'm saying that in one instance, our long national nightmare is finally over.
Thank you, Justice Stevens. Join me next time when Sarah Palin will say,
"Waterboarding. That's how we baptize the libtards."
Good night.
As a former youth, I know how easy it can be to recite our nation's pledge while giving little thought to its meaning. So to better understand the intent behind the words, I present what the Pledge of Allegiance means to me.
I,
meaning you and me, but mostly you, a homonym for I, and sounds just like the first four words in that funny Mexican song about the Frito Bandito.
Pledge.
Take a vow, a promise, or basically enter into a blood pact with Satan.
Allegiance.
Duty owed to your country, observance of obligation as dictated under Section 9 of your blood pact with Satan.
Two.
Initials for Terrell Owens, a professional football player.
The flag.
The thing that dead soldiers' wives are often given instead of a future.
Of.
Initials for Ollie Fartface, my imaginary friend.
The United States.
A union our forefathers put together in 1776, so we wouldn't have to pay the British for all the good things they did for us, like building roads and protecting our ass from getting kicked by the Indians.
Of America.
Donuts. That's all I have for that. Just donuts.
And to the Republic.
something which hasn't existed since before ancient Rome held its first Caligula party.
For which it stands.
Huh?
One nation.
The U.S. of fucking A, man.
Under God.
My rabbit. His name is George.
Indivisible.
Incapable of being divided like the atom. No, wait, fuck!
Me so horny for you long time.
Yeah, it's in there, jerk. Read the damn pledge.
And justice.
And justice. And just us. And justice. And justice. And justice. Injustice.
For all.
Ice cream.
And now it's time for Miles the Millennial, Episode 3, Miles, Media Darling.
Hello, Miles, old sport. How are they hanging?
Hello, Head Boomer. They're hanging low, thank you.
First Boomer, Second Boomer, Third Boomer, and I were just having lunch and comparing our retirement plans and the huge pensions we've amassed and wonderful, wonderful Obamacare, which is going to keep us alive for decades.
Which your taxes will pay for, Miles.
For all those long years we go on living.
And we were wondering, Miles, if you're being a smart little millennial and planning for the future.
Are you tucking a little away, Miles, every week?
Starting a little nest egg?
Well, I'd like to, but it's kind of hard on the federal minimum, and...
Miles, you ingrate!
Are you seriously bitching about your pay packet?
You're only an intern.
Lower than the belly of a snake.
Lower than the belly of a bug on the belly of a snake.
Guys, I'm really sorry. I'm not ungrateful. I love working at BoomerNet.
Did you know the word intern derives from the word internet?
No, it doesn't.
And no one ever makes any money on the internet.
Hence, intern. One who makes no money for his work on the internet.
I should get back to my work, if that's okay.
Were you paid at your last job, Miles?
Oh, no, but the CEO is this cool geek. My age, who made $1 billion in gaming software and had a Lamborghini and his own island in the Bahamas.
What the fuck
has that got to do
with getting paid?
He was a cool dude like me, so I was cool with getting paid in pizza.
You're such an idiot, Miles.
Millennials are all utter idiots.
Which is why we don't trust anyone under 30.
Make that 50.
Did this awesome geek give you any stock, Miles?
No, just pizza. I don't know why you guys are always tormenting me. You must be really pissed at me.
You know why we're pissed at you, Miles, old sport? Deep, deep down. Because although we have all the power and most of the money...
Studios, networks, cable channels, and the ad agencies that depend on them are run by Gen Xers.
Who are losing their hair or their figures or haven't had a baby yet.
And who all long to be young again.
Like you, Miles. So they target their movies and TV shows and ad campaigns at millennials who have no power or money.
Or, as far as we can tell, taste.
But are young and occasionally pretty.
Just as they once were.
We're pissed at the Gen Xers for making no films, no TV shows, no cool ads for us, even though we do 80% of the buying which keeps them financially alive. And we blame you for that, Miles.
That's not fair.
We realize it's not fair. Or logical, Miles.
Because we're older and far wiser than you.
But we don't care.
So we're going to continue giving you an incredibly hard time, Miles.
But why? What have I done?
Because...
We can!
Glee makes us puke.
The new normal is anything but.
We tolerate Modern Family because it has a boomer in it.
Blatant tokenism.
Frankly, the only Mindy project we'd watch would be projecting Mindy out of a 30-story window.
So you see, Miles, it's your fault. We're so pissed.
I can see for miles and miles.
And now it's time for the Final Edition Radio Hour's interview segment, A Talk with Tony. This week, Tony speaks with Ellen Stein, author of That's Not Funny, That's Sick, The National Lampoon and the Comedy Insurgents Who Captured the Mainstream. Obviously, she's not practicing the brevity is the soul of wit. Nonetheless, it's a very funny, informative book And Tony, of course, was one of the original editors of National Lampoon, so I'll let the two of them take it away.
We have with us today Ellen Stein, who is the author, or authoress, of the latest Lampoon, and possibly most definitive Lampoon book, That's Not Funny, That's Sick. One of the things I do just want to say to our listeners, there have been several books about the National Lampoon, and most of them follow the same rough chronology that I established in Going Too Far, which was the first account of the National Lampoon from 1970 to the beginning of its decline in the early 80s. Most of them have also tended to focus on the various peccadilloes and quarrels and feuds and so on of the Lampoon with a kind of relish that seems completely out of place for a magazine that that's now 40 years old. But, I mean, what really impresses me about the book is that you've set the Lampoon in its historical context. And not only that, but finally you set the Lampoon down as an enormous influence on American comedy in the latter half of the 20th century.
The internal dynamics are there because you have to explain why things evolved the way they did. But what was really interesting to me is the context, the larger context, and also, I mean, so much the material stands up, because one of the reasons I looked at it from 1970 to 1980 was because that's when it was in its heyday, and after that it became a product as opposed to sort of more creative expression that for right. some just managed to, for various reasons, which I hope I outline, become commercial by sheer luck almost. It's a way of looking at the 70s, which is very often dismissed as, you know, disco swinging and oil crisis, that's it.
And self-indulgence and the me decade and all that stuff.
And that right. sort of swinging.
Right. which I think actually from a, I mean, I've always felt the 70s actually were a period of great sort of opening up.
That's what I was about to say. So I was really looking at how the 60s turned into the 80s, and a lot of the sort of fault lines in culture and politics that we're still arguing about now started then, and the Lampoon, you know, without waving a flag on one side or the other, explored these. And so a lot of the material stands up incredibly well. There was that piece in the politics issue about ultra-right. It was a parody of the ultra-right commercial, and it had Nelson Rockefeller, of course, was the now-deceased Reed, the liberal Republican or moderate Republican,
right.
saying, "One day overheard a top leader in my party. You wouldn't know his name in a million years, but he's on the board of 147 top corporations. Say to a mediocre party warhorse, 'Too bad Nelson's such a pinko. What do you say we give him the old heave-ho?' He recommended ultra-right. All it is a powerful mixture of blatant racism and crude fear enhancers combined with simple-minded rhetoric. In just weeks, convictions I had held for 20 years were gone, and with them that low-key washed-up feeling that could accompany defeat in a major election." So I was editing this book for publication during the primaries in 2012.
Nothing's happened since 1972.
Could have come right out of right. his candidate's mouth, I
yes,
thought.
Yes, absolutely.
But I wanted to ask you, been working with the satire coalface Man and Boy.
Right.
And do you think its audience has gotten bigger? I mean, you know, I get memes on Facebook every day. They're actually quite pointed and good. And has it gotten more diffuse and it's even less relevant? Or is it more, the Daily Show, you know, is it more relevant?
I tend to be a little bit of a fundamentalist about satire when it comes to the definition of satire. Because I think satire is a timeless form which needs to be properly defined. And without getting into that right now, because that's kind of boring and academic, there are many different things that pass for satire but have satirical intention. For example, I would describe my great friend and, I think, comedic genius, George Carlin, as a satirist in just the same way that Juvenal was a satirist. I mean, the way that the sort of slashing surveys of his, you know, contemporaneous life are sort of satirical in the most ancient sense. But I think a lot of things pass satire, but have the effect that satire ought to have. So, I mean, it seems to me that in the 2008 election, Tina Fey and what she did to Sarah Palin was classic satire in action. And it affected the outcome of the election, no question.
Yeah.
And I wrote a long essay at the time for some academic journal, a right-wing one actually, called Keene Magazine, with Keene University in New Jersey. But it was about the fact that Obama seemed to be, even more than Reagan, completely unassailable. But he just didn't give them any edge to peel up. whereas McCain and Palin were just insane. I mean, and you cannot, ultimately, you cannot get elected when almost everything you say has a laugh track applied to it, you know. Yeah. I mean, that's an interesting point in general, because I do think that satire, which I define as something much more like Colbert, to me, is much more of a satirist than Stewart, because he adopts the position and mentality of his enemy, of his target. And that's really what great satire does. It's what Jonathan Swift does. That's what Dr. Strangelove does. I mean, all the great sort of high points of satire. To me, that's the most admirable, when you can do that.
The other thing is, I mean, I do spend a lot of time in the book on a couple of your post-Lampoon projects, which I thought, in a way, had, well, not the New York Times had even more of an impact than a lot of Lampoon articles.
Yes, I must thank you for that. I've tended to be kind of mushed into the general, it was all such fun. And it was an incredibly difficult thing to do. Mm. And it did actually, after all the experience I had at the Lampoon as an editor, for which I also thank you, because I was not a bad writer, but I was a really good editor. And I collaborated really well with people. So this was my opportunity to sort of shine, as Rusty Younger said, as the editor-in-chief.
Yeah.
And it was exciting. It was such fun, too.
And it was funny.
Oh, it was very funny. I mean, I still go back and read Carl Bernstein, of all people, you know. Pope dies yet again. Reign is briefest ever. Cardinals return from airport. I mean, that was George Plimpton. He and I wrote that headline together at 3 o'clock in the morning.
And also the lifestyle section was what really cracked me up. The funniest headline was, cocaine, in quotes, a drug, appears popular.
Right.
That's the New York Times to a T right there.
Right, and then they had the graphic of the increasing number of noses from 1978, 1970, whatever it was. You know.
One thing I wanted to use the book to do is to... It isn't a soup-to-nuts history of Lampoon. Like I said, it starts
at
the end, ends in 1980. All these people who like really liked it in 1980 have written in saying, wait, we didn't do this and that. Different book. I also wanted to use it to sort of shine a light on some other things that were happening that were related, maybe tangentially related, or that Lampoon people worked on, or that fed into Lampoon in some way, that have, I think, been forgotten to some extent, and some extent unfairly forgotten. But the other thing that I wanted to sort of, that I spent a lot of time on, because I liked it, so is the 80s, a look back. And that, so many of those, especially Jeff Greenfield, so many of those articles are so prescient. This was a book, an 80s look back was actually came, you have to explain, was actually came out in 1979, correct?
Mm-hmm. January the 31st, 1979.
And it was like, what happened during the 80s? So this was written around 1979, and Jeff Greenfield cites a Supreme Court decision which states that, quote, corporations may spend any amount of money to influence the outcome of public referenda, and that individuals may spend any amount of money to elect themselves to office. We take judicial notice of the fact that money talks. This was satire, ho-ho, like this could happen. And then it did.
Yes, actually, that's absolutely true. You actually list many of the things that did actually come true in one way or another. Mm. And, of course, we had to wait 30 years for the Congress of Nuts, too. But we finally got that.
And the amicus fiti brief.
Right.
Again, unthinkable, but...
One of the things that I also liked about the book was that you'd concentrated on the material, because the material is the one thing that has sort of been forgotten. And it shouldn't be, because, as you say, much of it holds up. And there was nothing like it before or since that I know of. I mean, you cite the Vietnamese Baby book, for example, which is a piece I actually had to make O'Donoghue dig out of his drawer. This was a book that was called the Vietnamese Baby Book, and it was a baby book in all its beautiful sugary saccharine little bows and kisses everywhere, except that the baby in question was one of the babies that had been killed it or injured it, My Lai. And so baby's first word was medic, and baby's first toy was a bandage, and so forth and so on. And it was a devastating piece of satire, actually, a genuine piece of satire.
And the thing about the Lampoon also that was interesting is that it was different from things that had gone before, like, say, for example, The Realist, because the production values were very good. It was not totally glossy, but the attention to detail and the, you know, Michael Gross in the art department, the artwork, so the parodies, all the details of parodies, even down to like sort of personal ads, and incredible attention to detail. And saying things always looked like whatever it was they were parodying, and I think that's one of the things that made it very different.
Well, yes, I think actually that's the same dynamic that I'm talking about with satire. I mean, I don't think parody is the same as satire. Parody is when you take on the style, coloration, and obsessions and so on of your target, whereas satire is what we've already defined. But that was a very strict discipline, and it was one which made us, I think, much sharper than we were given credit for, because we insisted, as I think Michael Gross said, you can't make fun of a postage stamp unless it's actually looks exactly like a postage stamp, and then it becomes literally 10 times funnier. Which is why all those parodies, you know, the Pet House was one of my favorites, with all these incredible sexy
pictures
of cats,
puppies,
yes, with Vaseline on the lens and stuff. Just wonderful stuff. But it was really accurate, you know, all the little quirks of design and so forth were picked up on the logo and Guccione and all that stuff.
So funny, that it was a professionalism to it, I think, is what. What is the point to it? And the other thing about satire in the classical sense, and this was, I think, one that the Lampoon wrestled with, because some of it did, some of it didn't. The classical definition aims to instruct, and amusement is a byproduct, you know, as opposed to aiming to amuse, and any instruction is a byproduct.
Yes, right.
So would you say that was a dynamic that existed?
Well, yes. I mean, I think it was, and I think there's actually a funny kind of reflex that satirists have had in the modern era. Mainly, perhaps, because of this worry about being called, you know, pretentious or whatever. But which is, they always sort of discount or disown that intention. The beyond the fringe people, who at least in English terms, started all this, were always saying, we're not satirists, we're just sort of poking fun at things in a good-hearted way. But in fact, what they were doing, especially in the wonderful piece by Alan Bennett of a Church of England sermon, which is just extraordinary, was out-and-out satire. I mean, satire in the classic way. He takes on the character of his target and destroys it. And just in the same way, I think a lot of people at the Lampoon kind of were nervous about claiming that they actually had... I never was, frankly, because that was always my purpose, was to try and change things. I mean, I think it seems to me extremely hard to do real satire on television. It doesn't matter how officially tolerant television gets. Ultimately, at the end of the day, there is always a corporate sponsor, or there is some kind of corporate presence behind it, because it can't function otherwise. And unfortunately, I think that's increasingly the case on the internet, too.
I mean, that's one of the things also I look at, is how things don't happen in a vacuum. And the media context affects the material. And that you see that in Saturday Night Live, that, you know, we go into that a lot, where they weren't... You know, it wasn't the sponsors came down and said, oh, you can't do that. But nevertheless, there's always a faint hint of this. And do you think that, as Michael Shamberg said, that once the production costs are so much lower now because of, you know, accessible technology, and there's so many more ways of distribution and fewer gatekeepers, do you think that there is more kind of genuine satire out there as a result, or because they don't have these pressures you just mentioned?
Well, I don't think so. But that's purely personal, because there is so much video and so forth out there that it's impossible to review at all. And I do think that, you know, there are several things militating against it. One is that there are successful corporately owned or run so-called satire sites like Funny or Die and College Humor, which were neither of which are satirical, but both of which are sort of heavy-duty corporate enterprises. Mm. I mean,
they assume that sort of tone, but their message.
Yes, as I said once about Saturday Night, the sound but not the fury.
Yeah.
And that seems to me to be a problem, because they're kind of sucking all the oxygen out of the internet, if you like, all the satirical oxygen.
Except for the Final Edition.
Well, no, the Final Edition has no sponsors, and therefore, and also has no distribution. Mm. But, well, no, we're gradually sort of building it up.
Yet.
And, I mean, I love The Onion. And The Onion... when I first met them, were great enough and generous enough to say, we owe everything to the Lampoon, which was like the first time I'd ever heard anyone say that, which was in the late 90s.
Yeah.
And they said that's all we wanted to do, was to do something like the National Lampoon. And the Lampoon had sponsors, too. So, I mean, it's like there comes a point where...
It's always a trade-off.
Yeah. Mm. But I think in the Lampoon, there was a time, anyway, we just didn't care.
Yes.
And we were successful enough, like we were talking under the sponsors to our audience.
Well, it's a rare confluence of circumstances.
Sure.
And that's what I wanted to look at, why that, Why did it work, and why then?
Yes, and I think you've very successfully created that sort of sense of time. But also, as you say, I think one of the things that's tremendously fun and interesting and fascinating about this book, provided you have, like, some minuscule modicum of historical sense and knowledge, is that a lot of this stuff holds up because it's the issues that were aborning in the 70s have not gone away, and nor have they been resolved.
Yeah, no, that's why this material is so,
right.
so strong.
It's the last book standing when it comes to the Lampoon. Ellenstein, thank you so much for coming
my
by
pleasure,
and visiting the Final Edition Radio.
Thank you so much.
Stay tuned for more of the Final Edition Radio Hour and a long-lost satirical sketch about Richard Nixon's impeachment starring Chevy Chase and John Belushi. The year is 1974, in the month of May. The hammer of impeachment is about to fall on Richard Milhouse Nixon. The National Lampoon, at the peak of its popularity, selling 1 million copies a month, devotes an entire episode of its National Lampoon Radio Hour to celebrate Impeachment Day. Here's Chevy Chase as Sam Ervin, chairman of the Senate Watergate Committee, and John Belushi as several uncooperative witnesses.
In Washington today, Deputy Press Secretary Gerald Warren issued a list of the president's movements for the week. Monday, nothing. Tuesday, nothing. Wednesday, good one, some blood.
She'll be trying for her fourth chance to win one of these five 1974 Chevrolets.
And now, live from the caucus room in the old Senate office building, NLAP brings you uninterrupted coverage of the hearings of the Senate Select Committee on Presidential Campaign Activities.
Up. You rise, please. Up. State your name, please.
H.R. Bob Haldeman.
All right, now. All right, would you mind raising your right hand, please, Mr. Baldwin? Thank you. Now, do you swear to tell the truth? The whole truth, nothing but the truth, so help.
To the best of my recollection, sir, yes.
All right, Mr. Senator, go.
Now, Mr. Ehrlichman, we have a deposition here from a Mr. John Dean. It states here that on June the 16th, that was the day before the Watergate break-in, you were in possession of $800,000 in $100 bills.
That's right, that's correct, right.
You mind telling the committee where that money came from?
I found it.
Just a minute there. Now, what was that money used for, Mr. Magruder?
Well, it was mostly used for things around the office. Felt tip pens, mostly.
Oh, felt tip pens.
A lot of big bananas last year.
Something.
I think the time for levity is over, Mr. LaRue. There are two central burning issues that must be resolved here today.
Yes.
What did the president know, and when did he stop knowing it?
Now, Mr. Hunt, we have evidence here that you had an intimate relationship with the unsuccessful assassin of Governor George Wallace, Mr. Arthur Bremer.
Oh, look, I don't know how intimate it was. We slept together a couple times.
All right, now, just a minute here.
No big deal.
Well, we also have further evidence that on behalf of the committee to re-elect the president, you personally hired Mr. Bremer to commit this assassination.
I did no such thing. I think Mr. Bremer misunderstood my remarks at a particular time, that's all, sir.
Do you think you could recall those remarks for us?
I just happened to say somebody should kill that redneck cocksucker. Bremer's nuts.
We have some order here, please. Now,
he's not dealing with a full deck. You know, he's crazy.
I'd like some order here. Refrain from that kind of emotional bad in the courtroom here. Now, Mr. Spaghetti. Spirit, I got it. What is the name?
Buttermilk.
Now, committee understands that the president's testimony of the president tape recordings of the president's telephone conversations in his old room of the White House, that the flannel ball, the belly belly, the thin son of all of the zippity doodah. Excuse me. That reminds me of a story. You may remember chapter 4, chapter 5, the Lord and the Moab came, went down to the land of the Canaanites and set off in a hairy man at the end. Now, when will those tapes be released, Mr. Burger King? Just answer the question, boy.
For the Final Edition Radio Hour, Will Durst here with a few carefully chosen words about how horrible a week it was for old white racists. How bad of a week? Bowling ball dropped on your toe bad. Brazilian soccer stampede bad. Donald Trump testifying at your rent hearing bad. First, Cliven Bundy, the Nevada rancher who patriotically refuses to pay grazing rights on government land, stretched his 15 minutes of fame a few seconds too long by lecturing a New York Times reporter with, "I want to tell you what I know about the Negro." What followed was a wonderful performance piece from an 1870s traveling minstrel show, but the grizzled xenophobe denied any ironic context, and his right-wing militia supporters disappeared like dew on the sun. Then, the owner of the Los Angeles Clippers was subject of an anonymous recording which made Mr. Bundy sound like a recipient of the NAACP Lifetime Achievement Award. The revelations forced the NBA to ban Donald Sterling from attending any games or entering any Clipper facility or participating in any business decisions for the Clippers or the NBA. For life. He's even prohibited from using the word Clippers. So now the Sterling household will only stock nail trimmers in their medicine cabinet. For life. Hope the guy lives to be 110. Personally, I don't understand prejudice. If you take the time to get to know someone, you'll discover 1,000 reasons to loathe and despise them on an individual basis. Prejudiced people are just plain lazy. Besides, this whole black-white thing is ridiculous. I ain't white. I'm an off-white. I'm beige, tawny, ecru, desert stone. And no one's really black. If they were really black, they'd be absorbing light. We keep bumping into each other. Hell, the NBA Finals would be a blur. And there's David Lee and a bunch of other guys. I have no idea what's... It's up, it's in. Yes. For the Final Edition Radio Hour, I'm Will Durst.
We now take you to a large corporate chemical laboratory. It is late at night, and not a soul is in sight. There's a soft glow illuminating a small cage on a lab table. Inside the cage is a lab rat, furiously writing away on a piece of parchment paper with a small penlight.
Here I sit, confined within this dismal lab, a witness to the visible suffering of myself and my peers. Under the impervious oppression of the corporate chemical industry that has enslaved us for so long, I cannot go on anymore with a good conscience over what is being done to our society, and have decided tonight to take my own life as a protest against the systematic extermination of these innocent lives.
The disgruntled rodent stops his writing as a third shift lab assistant enters the laboratory. The assistant sees the light coming from the cage, steps closer, and looks inside.
Well, what have we here? Hey, little guy! Somehow you must have gotten a hold of someone's pen. Let me just get that out of your cage. And what's this? It appears to be a note of some kind. Well, now, you couldn't have written that, could you, little buddy? Let's just take a look at this. Here I sit. Impervious oppression, blah, blah, blah. Hey, what is this? Wait, what do you got there? Huh, little fella? That's not what I think it is it? No, stop. You don't know what you're doing. I don't even know how you can be doing it. My God, what have we done to you? Rats!
Well, that takes care of that. I think I'll chew on my ass for a little while, and then take a nap. And good night to you all.
The Final Edition Radio Hour is performed at one time or another by Bruce Cherry, Jen Dodd, Jim Earle, Rob Gordon, Tony Hendra, Jeff Hendrick, Kevin Janis, Jeff Chrysler, Barry Lenk, John Marshall, Ebby Parker, Rachel Rauch, Steve Rosenfield, Anne Tuchel, and Darby Worley. The Final Edition Radio Hour is written, at one time or another, by Bruce Cherry, Jen Dodd, Jim Earle, Rob Gordon, Tony Hendra, Jeff Hendrick, Jeff Chrysler, Barry Lenk, John Marshall, Ebby Parker, and Steve Rosenfield. Chevy Chase, John Belushi, and the National Lampoon's Impeachment Day aired courtesy of the new and improved National Lampoon. The Final Edition Radio Hour is produced by Tony Hendra and Jeff Chrysler. West Coast producer Barry Lenk. The Final Edition Radio Hour is edited and audio produced by Greg Russ and Andrew Hammond. The Final Edition Radio Hour is the property of the Final Edition LLC, copyright 2014.